people of the earth, throw down your weapons. Well, hello from high up in the Hollywood Hills. We are the Unoffendables. I am Tom Rhodes. Hooray for humanity.
And I'm Lou Angel Wolf. Shalom, y'all.
And I'm Dana Gibson. Word to the mothership.
Word to the mothership. I love it. I feel very nostalgic. This is the first time I've been in the Hollywood Hills since I moved. I lived in the Hollywood Hills when I had a sitcom on NBC.
Yeah, when did you live here, Tom?
I lived here. I had the sitcom. It was 96 to 97.
Right.
I played a school teacher, had the long hair.
Sure.
And this is where I lived. Actually, my place was a little higher. But I was a renter.
A couple more laps.
So,
right, yeah.
You know. And I had the most magnificent rock star apartment, all glass windows, overlooking all of the lights of Los Angeles. And I lived with a beautiful actress, and all we did was ever walk around naked with, you know, goblets of wine.
As God intended.
It was one of the greatest experiences of my life.
Listening to some soul music.
So it's like, I'm, you know, to be back up here, wow.
Yeah, I got to visit you a couple times, and that was a really cool pad. You had a great balcony, and he'd sit out there and sip his coffee and write material.
Oh, it was so great to start the day there, and then at night, all the throbbing lights of Los Angeles. I felt like, you know, then you feel like you make it when you're living in the Hollywood Hills.
Hey, when this town
loves
you.
Hey, I'm in a Bob Seger song.
when this town loves you, it's wonderful.
Yeah, anywhere, any town is good when it's working for you, you know?
I remember visiting you there and bringing you a couple of French broads.
I remember, that's so great you brought that up. I remember, what did I play for them? I played them like,
Damon, that's part of the agency.
Dana is my Christopher Columbus of cool. She has always discovered the coolest places and people and introduced me to some of the most hippest people I've ever met in my life, other than when I lived in Europe. You're my barometer of cool and everything.
And consequently, look at the way the world has spun, and here we all three are tonight. Amazing.
It's super groovy.
Absolutely amazing.
Dana, you're super groovy. Now, you actually live here. Lou and I are just visiting. I'm a gypsy. I don't live anywhere. And you're still like hobnobbing. And I love the place. You know, you live in off of Franklin. It's such a cool part of town by the Scientology headquarters. You've probably seen Tom Cruise turn into a bat and float off the balcony.
Well, the best, right? The best and cheapest tourist entertainment I can give anybody in America is to go to the Scientology Celebrity Center outside. There's bicycle security guys that are like 13 years old. They look very young. And they're just circling around the center. It's a castle. It was William Randolph Hearst's house where he used to sneak.
Oh, I didn't know that.
There's a tunnel underneath it going diagonally to another beautiful building on Franklin where he would hide, not so much hide, but he had Marion Davies living.
Wow.
So whenever she wanted to groove around the tunnel, make it happen.
Wow.
And his wife was in the Celebrity Center.
That's
what
I love about you. You're always filled with little factoids about Hollywood knowledge and, like, you know, Hollywood star tours are worthless. It's stupid. But like Dana Gibson is the person who knows where the coolest of the coolest.
You rent Dana Gibson a minivan, a couple cocktails. you're going to hear some stories.
Somebody else is driving.
Why don't you get a minivan with a little cocktail
emphasis
bar?
On somebody else is driving.
That'll be a side thing. We'll have really cool custom tours.
Don't you think like drinking is the best way to meet people in Hollywood? Because you like to frolic. You're like me. You know, we're from the same cloth. You're the life of the party. Any party you're going to be at, you're going to light it up. So, because remember in the 90s, like people were all in rehab, and that was the place to meet cool people in Hollywood. Don't you think that's like
the sip the Evian and kind of?
Am I wrong? Is that
the backwards nod? Yeah, that's kind of going away. I think people are Hollywood's getting its groove back. I swear.
Is it?
And what about because you showed me all about Hollywood Boulevard, how it's having this renaissance and there's money coming in.
It's amazing.
They've driven off the prostitutes and the junkies and the homeless people.
They did what every city in America does traditionally. They just slide them around. They're out there. You just kind of shift them like.
Yeah, sure. Hey, we're from New York, you know?
Yeah.
But you're living in the heart of Hollywood.
Yeah, I can actually walk around. The Walk of Fame is my walk to get a...
I've been. You showed me, and I love it. And it's just such a thrill to walk over those stars.
What's your favorite face to step on every day?
John Lennon I don't step on, but every day I go by the picture of the Beatles at Capitol Records.
Right.
And Sinatra has several, which I started thinking, am I doing this right? But he's one of the only stars. He has three. He has a TV, movies and a record.
Dana
he's
took
the chairman
me
of the board.
Yeah, he's Frank. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Dana took me the one time I asked her, "Hey, where's the John Lennon star?" She told me she knew exactly where it was.
The absolutely free entertainment is the guys that circle around the Celebrity Center on bicycles and weigh like 120 pounds, and they're like 18-year-old boys.
Wow.
All you have to do, simple thing, any time of the day or night, just say, "Hey, I heard Tom Cruise is in there." And they act like a robot that somehow got a glitch. They're like, I can't tell you. Like, you just mentioned Tom Cruise. Their bike stops and they start paralyzed. Trembling.
It's the Barictai. What was the thing from the day the Earth stood still? They said to the robot, Barictai, Noctu, whatever.
It's like the $6 million man when Roger put his hand on the stove and he started melting because he was a robot, too.
But across from the Scientology Center, that's one of my favorite parts of Los Angeles. There's that really cool old bookstore. And they sell vinyl records. I've found like some old classic.
It's a San Francisco vibe right there.
Total
in the
San Francisco
of
vibe on this one little block area of Los Angeles. And there's this bar that Dana hangs out at. She turned me on to it, and I've stayed at her house. And should we say the name of the place?
Well, it's
but
right.
It's where like a lot of stars and people hang out.
It's kind of like an institute, though.
I mean, Birds. Yeah, it's been there. It's across from the Scientology Center.
Very well.
And you turned me on to the place. The last time we had drinks last night, because I haven't seen you in a while, but the last time before I was there was about 8 months ago, and I'm outside having lunch on the patio, on the sidewalk patio, and David Carradine walks in. Kung Fu. And I had just found the first season of Kung Fu.
Right.
And I had just watched every episode back to back.
And it seemed meant to be.
I worshipped Kung Fu. And then David Carradine comes walking into this restaurant. And I sat up. I felt like a schoolgirl. My crush, my man crush on David Carradine. He walked immediately out 3 minutes later. And as he's walking out, he crumpled up a piece of paper and he threw it on the ground.
Oh.
And I was just so offended. I was like, I just wanted to yell, you know, "Hey, grasshopper.
What up?
Litter bugs are losers, pal." You know?
Yeah, it's always a shame to finally meet somebody and then have...
And then it's a total disappointment. What are the biggest stars you've ever met that were disappointments?
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. You got to be careful, you know, who you look up to, because you never know when it's going to all, you know, be something totally different. But the grooviest part of Hollywood is that you see the stars that you kind of, you know, random from your childhood just pop out of the woodwork, and then you're talking with them, and... You know, that's the part that's really enchanting to me.
Well, like you and I went to that party in it was here, actually. We're in the same place where the party was. It was a really cool party, a lot of cool old Dean Martin's son was there, who I still have
daughter.
A crush on to this day. Daughter, I'm sorry. And there was like really cool people, and Anson Williams was there. And, I didn't have the same feeling I did for David Carradine, but I mean, who doesn't love Happy Days? Yeah. And
the Potty years.
I was just, he was such a nice, lovable guy. And I was only disappointed in, you know, of course you think, well, if this guy acts like an asshole or has too much to drink and he's a jerk to his wife, I'll go, "Sit on it, Potsy." waiting for that moment, but it never came.
Yeah, he was the coolest, and he was so sweet because he still was excited that I cared.
He was going back to Milwaukee because they were going to make a bronze statue of the Fonz and unveil it, and the Happy Days people were going. And Dana and I laughed forever. It just sounds like a euphemism for masturbating. Hey, I'm going to bronze the Fonz. Just like, it's good for any. It's like a clean euphemism that you could use for anything.
Hey, you guys take it easy. I'm going to go bronze the Fonz. You know what I'm saying?
Hey, man, I think that show was groundbreaking in so many ways because it was sweet.
Right. Yeah.
But, man, Henry Winkler was just pounding on the jukebox a couple times, and he had two chicks in the bathroom with him, and everyone just said, "That's the Fonz," you know?
It's the Fonz.
And it was totally innocent.
He'd snap his finger, and a girl would roll into his arms and kiss him.
Well.
And, I mean, I loved that show.
And we still cheer for that idea.
Well, you know what?
What other shows that made you that happy? I mean, my mother and my sister, we had a thing with Barney Miller.
Mm-hmm.
When Barney Miller was in syndication a few years after it stopped running, you know, it was like on WGN or one of those shows that, when you have the cheapest cable program package.
Yeah.
Like when cable first came out, and me and my mom and my sister could have been in different parts of the house, but when that boom,
oh, yeah.
Ba-da-ba-boom, when the Barney Miller's theme would come on,
it was out.
We would come running from every direction in the house, and we would, as a family, well, me and my mom and my sister, parents are divorced, and my older brothers have moved away, that was like, a real family moment that we had. And, you know, what other shows have ever given you that feeling where you felt a connection to it?
I have a Hal Linden story.
I'd love to hear.
I'd love a Hal
Linden. Name dropper.
I'll get that.
Excuse me, I call a Hal Linden. No, for 5,000. No,
Hal Linden for 5,000, please.
No, I was 18, living in Boston, going to Northeastern, being very studious, and working at the Stage Deli of New York, which was in the the theater district, all the off-Broadway shows.
Wonderful place.
So everybody that came in, literally, I was carrying like as much, many, many mink coats were being carried because they had no coat room, and I was always like, God, I've got like 20 mink coats on me, and here I go. And so I waited on Hal Linden, and I had a moment because there he is, and I was 18, and I had grown up with him. And he was with his father, who was quite elderly and dear, and they were sweet, and they tipped me like $200, and I was thrilled. And at the end of it, Hal Linden came up to me, and he said, you know, I just have to tell you, my dad, at some juncture in the dinner, he pulled his teeth out, and I think they threw him away.
Oh, my God.
Like, and I didn't know, and we didn't know, and I'm really sorry. And this is a Stage Deli in New York. Five dining rooms. Everyone has their ass on fire to go to an off-Broadway show. Everything's like, I gotta go!
Right.
And they show up 15 minutes before and have like 20 people having dinner.
Wow.
And so I worked the miracle. And
they order roast duck.
I run like lightning into every... It starts speaking Spanglish and produced the said false teeth in 10 minutes.
Wow. Lifesaver.
Yeah. And then Hal Linden, literally, I think we fell in love at that moment. Because I kept it on the DL. And I was like,
still very handsome guy.
He would remember you up to this day.
Now, I think television is the most powerful medium in the world. I mean, not everyone has a microwave in their home, but everyone has a television. I mean, do you think it's possible to transcend humanity through television, or is it just it's too corporate and commercially owned that people
intelligence? Miracles can happen through television.
Absolutely.
It reaches the world.
Absolutely. Well, look at the groovy disposition that people had that grew up with H.R. Puff and stuff and laughing. And all those things that, you know, love American Style?
Love American Style. I love that show.
Before we get too far away, can I drop an H.R. Puff and Stuff?
Hey.
Oh my God, please bring it back to H.R. Puff and Stuff.
I have probably the most wonderful H.R. Puff and Stuff love story.
Do you know that I still
everybody in this room.
Do you know that I still will not go near trees at night because of H.R. Puff and Stuff?
I love the way there was...
Do you remember that? The trees would grab you.
They needed moisture.
Oh, I loved H.R. Puff and Stuff.
Sid and Marty Krofft.
His flute was his friend.
Sure.
His flute was his best friend.
How symbolic was that? But anyway. The last year, Billy Hayes always played Witchy Pooh.
Yeah.
But the last year, Billy Hayes didn't re-up her... Billy Hayes didn't re-up her contract to play Witchy Pooh again. And an actress named Louise Duart... actually played Witchy Pooh the last year. And Louise and I dated in the early 90s after she had divorced. And she's a wonderful, wonderful woman. I love her to this day. But that's always funny because a lot of the guys, when it was actually happening, a lot of the
she's
guys
probably
going,
a gay icon without knowing it. Like the real Witchy
she's
Pooh.
She's huge in the gay community.
Yeah. Like what huge. Spiritual significance did you get from H.R. Puff and Stuff, Dana?
I felt like the world could be a kaleidoscope of kindness. I just felt like everybody, there were so many different things going on that there were opportunities. It was just so positive. It was light.
Yes. And the thing I liked about it, too, is evil was so obvious.
Yeah. You know, and
evil was...
We should all be so lucky.
Yeah, if evil was that obvious, you know. I mean, really, I really do wish the devil would walk around in a red phosphorus suit. Oh, there he is, you know, as opposed to being in a little black dress.
Sure. My mom always said something very groovy to me, is that people will tell you who they are, you just have to listen.
Wow.
So a lot of people will subtly be like, no, really, I'm a bad guy, because I tend to...
True
like,
that, Mama Gibson.
Word to the mothership.
I tend
in the immortal words of Dana Gibson.
No, but the way I do it, my disposition is I will love you until you basically hit me over the head with a frying pan and say, no, I'm bad.
Please,
that's
stop
true. Dana's
me.
Like that, yeah.
Stop loving me.
Yeah, well, I know the three of us, and I think that we're all a kind to a fault.
The one piece that I've always some showbiz wisdom given to me by somebody incredible, but I forget who. They said when it comes to Los Angeles, make sure your name gets there first.
Make sure your reputation.
Yeah, you have to come to Los Angeles because that's where the project is.
That's brilliant because I never wanted to move here. I moved
because to come out here and swim upstream.
I got I got offered the sitcom. I was living in San Francisco. I had a good reputation. You're right on the money.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when I lived in Koreatown, no, I just moved here like a punk.
Right. Well, and that's the thing is like you got to make sure your name gets here first.
And it's something where if you are focused and you're from the East Coast or you stand out in some way, you really do have a good time at it because there's a lot of Jeff Spicolis. With a trust fund that are like, dude, this is going to be great.
But you've done it right because, you have that place. You have the place on Franklin. Mm-hmm. And then you also spend a lot of time at your boyfriend's house out at the beach. So mm-hmm. you turned me on to, I was like, wow, L.A. can be done really nicely.
Yeah, yeah. It's just it's a series of small towns. And anywhere I live, when I lived in San Francisco, I'd pretend I was in a small town in my neighborhood. Each little, it's all the way that you want to look at the way things are going on.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
If
you sit and watch Cops and Gangland, you're not going to leave the house.
Yeah, true TV needs to be stopped. The number one thing for me is that when I was a kid, I would watch Happy Days and, all those groovy shows. I didn't realize how good I had it because that was just my disposition was like this, wow, groovy. Everything's exciting and sure. And so sweet, really sweet. And
I'm getting new shoes.
No, but it's just sweet, very gentle, very docile.
Sure.
Yeah. What's sorry.
No, but now everywhere you turn, there's some Moida show. And it used to be if there was a murder show on when I was growing up, it was like Robert Wagner was fighting crime and then he was drinking champagne at the end.
A simple solution. And evil was clearly defined, like you were saying about H.R. Puff and stuff. Now, Dana and Lou, you guys are two of my oldest, best friends on the planet, and both of you emanate so much love and goodness, and that's why you've been my oldest, best friends in the world. What is the best advice anyone has ever given you in your life?
The best advice about
anything, about life, show business, life, whatever.
Okay, I don't know if it's the best because my whole life is an amalgamation of little pieces of wisdom. But this was probably one of the
triple word bonus score.
Thank you. this is a piece that I always hold with me. I was doing a gig playing in St. Thomas in the Virgin Islands. And I was at a resort, and we had adventured into town for the day. And at the end of the day, what the trick is to get back to town before the cruise ships come in. Because it goes from like 15,000 people to like 150,000 people in a matter of hours. And to try to drive out of there is trouble. Well, anyway, I had a particularly fun day that day and got in the cab too late. Big Jamaica Rastafarian guy playing some really, really cool music on the cab. And I know it's going to be a while before I make it back to the resort. But anyway, I'll be there in time for the show. No sweat. So I'm sitting there listening to the guy, and we're talking back and forth, and we're just talking about the beautiful day and the mist in the air, and everything was just wonderful. And this other cab driver comes up, cuts us off. We got to rock the brakes. Everything goes flying. The hula girl on the dashboard is dancing. And my cab driver says, "Stop fighting life, man.
Stop fighting life, man.
Stop fighting life, man." He didn't hit the horn. He didn't yell at the guy. He just made one little comment, and I have taken that as such a complete piece of wisdom for all my days. I don't get really stressed out in traffic. I don't get stressed out in daily situations because that's something I can't control. And that guy really helped me let go of all those crazy things.
That's a good choice to make.
Yeah, and I mean, and there's thousands of other things that I've learned, but that particular one is easy to repeat and very poignant because – what is traffic? I mean, what are you going to be 18 feet ahead of the next guy? I mean, what's the...
People get so worked up and full of anger,
oh
and they flip out.
Yes. And you know what? But we have to actually feel sorry for them.
Yeah, you have to just love them into submission.
Exactly. You have, the way...
love them into submission.
That's exactly
I love that. I can see the bumper stickers coming off the printing press right now.
The sleeper
love them into submission.
Hey, man, if you're going to say you're a Christian or whatever, it's simple fundamentals of being a quality human being. Just evolve yourself enough that you don't, flip the hell out on Sunset Boulevard because some jackass in a Rolls Royce decided he owns the road. Well, big surprise. You give a guy a bunch of money when he's 21, he has a Rolls Royce, he's going to be a jackass for a little while.
What's the best advice you've ever been given, Dana?
I will say, just to make it short and simple,
no, take whatever. Take your time. I have several.
I just have advice. I have a philosophy from my dad being in World War II and being such a young person. From my dad was on D-Day. Hello. And it just seems absurd that that's the story of my life. But he was picking cotton in Kentucky. They pulled him out of fifth grade. And he just volunteered before they could even draft him for World War II because he figured anything is better than this. And so I always, you know, as a kid growing up in small town Amish country, Pennsylvania, I had plenty of time on my hands.
Mm-hmm. And lots of cheese.
You know what I don't like about the Amish? They won't sell you their hats.
I got one.
Really?
Oh, I made friends with this.
Really?
I got drunk with these Amish guys. That's a whole other story.
Wow.
But
Dana, see, I told you, this girl knows how to schmooze.
She's been drunk with the Amish.
I can schmooze people named Friedman Beiler. I'm not trying to brag, but I'm dropping a Friedman Beiler.
Hey, Jeremiah.
Hey, Jim.
So what's to do in this little village? I'm sorry. Please finish your story.
No, but I guess from, you know, knowing... I think beauty comes out, obviously comedy is tragedy on a tight turnaround, and you know, knowing a beautiful life is knowing also a lot of pain and deciding what to do with, how to process that. So sure. My dad, coming from this whole, I walked across France and was promptly shot and, you know, whatever, then I just thought, what am I talking about? You know, I'm over here and I get to, you know, have a groovy life in the 70s and, yeah. And then I get to travel around. So I went around Europe and went where he went during the war and couldn't believe how beautiful, beautiful, stunning Normandy Beach is.
Oh, yeah.
That you can't picture a war going on in any of these places. You really can't. Yeah. And then there's tangible, you know, things that remind you it did happen. Yes, indeed. But anyway, so I was in Italy and I was talking to this very old man. I love talking to older people. And we were speaking the international language of love. We were just barely communicating, you know, with whatever broken words we could understand.
Nice.
And I was telling him how I love the Southern European lifestyle of relaxing and, you know, having sex and having a nice lunch, drinking wine. You know, it just seemed like, where did we miss that bus? And then he said, and I was complimenting him on Italy, and he said, you know, it doesn't matter where you are in the world as long as your life is beautiful.
Amen. Wow.
And then I thought, well, there you go.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, that's nice.
I love it. I've been getting now, you know, you guys just reminded me of several. You in the car in Jamaica, wherever you were. there was one time I was in Toronto, and there was an Iranian taxi driver. The guy was from Tehran, Muslim guy, said the most beautiful thing to me. He said, people misuse religion because they don't understand nature.
Yes.
Oh. Everyone wants to make money, so that's why they brainwash the people. We are all one. There is no other truth.
Amen. No.
And you know what? I left that guy a really good tip.
I would too.
And then my other biggest advice for as far as being a comedian, my mother years ago took tennis lessons. And my mother, I asked her how it was going once, and she said, "It's okay, honey." And I've always applied this to comedy. I said, "So, Mom, how's the tennis going?" She goes, "It's okay, honey. You know, to do it right, you never want to get frazzled, and you want to smack the shit out of the big ones." And that was it. And then I think the other greatest advice I ever received was from Madonna in the song Holiday, when she says we all need to take a break out of life and celebrate. I mean, you know, Holiday.
This is coming from...
I think the words to Madonna's Holiday...
Your mother and Madonna made it on the same page.
I think the words to Madonna's Holiday should be taped in as the last page of the Bible.
Okay. I don't feel that way, but nice.
I'm tickled to my spine because we have John Fugelsang as our guest tonight. And John, veteran stand-up comedian, many David Letterman appearances.
Well, not quite, but over 25 on Bill Maher, which I think is a record.
Ah.
Now, yeah. I did Politically Incorrect twice, and I barely got a word in edgewise. How did you do? Well, obviously you did good if they brought you back.
They kept bringing me back. Well, they used to have me on a lot because for the first couple of years, they'd have me on whenever it was a religious topic. Ah. So, like, because my mom is an ex-nun, my father's an ex-Franciscan brother. And so I do a lot of material about Jesus and his fan club. And
is your father's name Saint Francis?
No, but that was his order.
So, wow. St. Francis is one of my heroes in life.
One of mine, too. And my dad was a Franciscan. He taught Catholic school history to boys in Brooklyn. He wore the brown robes and the rope belt and walked amongst the people like the lost Jedi Knight of Flatbush. But so they would have me on all the time for all the... So when I was like in my mid-20s when I moved out to L.A., and I was always getting on to like debate Jerry Falwell when I'm 26,
wow,
things like that. So it was a curious way to earn Dad's love, but it worked.
Salty.
So how did your dad feel about that?
He loved it. I was on with Jerry Falwell, and he was bragging, I'm pro-life, I'm pro-life, I'm pro-life. And I said, yeah, but you support the death penalty, Rev, so you're pro some life. And you could hear his sphincter tighten across the studio floor. And, you know, when your dad's a liberal ex-clergy Catholic history teacher, you have weird ways to earn his love.
So your parents were, like, super liberal, and that kind of is how you mushroomed into the love flower that you are?
Sort of like that. Sort of like that. I prefer to say flower into the love mushroom I am now. But, they were very liberal politically. Around my house, there was, you know, it was just Jesus, Gandhi, Dr. King. Jesus, Gandhi, Dr. King. Ronald Reagan.
That's like my, you sound like the parents I wish I would have had.
Well, very, very progressive politically, very conservative socially. They did not want us to be Republicans, but they wanted us to dress like them. Mm-hmm. And my parents hadn't lived like normal people since the 50s, and their fashion taste had stayed in the 50s. So growing up in the 70s, you know, like you look at all the kids had long, shaggy hair and cool clothes, and I was like with the plaid checkered pants and the clip-on bow tie and the Clark Kent bow glasses. My third grade picture is like 27 little Allman Brothers and Buddy Holly's inbred cousin. So
they didn't want you to be disruptive.
Exactly. I had a buzz cut in 79, you know, nice. Not exactly.
And you grew up in New York City?
Long Island, actually.
Wow.
In the heart of the Guido Belt. So,
in the original housing development?
In one of them, yeah. We lived in a relatively new house where every third unit was the same. And look out the window, and there's an IROC and a dead dog, and there we go. We're on Long Island.
Don't you love Levittown?
Oh, I grew up in Bohemia, the most
nice.
Ironically named town in all of America.
I love it.
Bohemia, Long Island. Where
I just picture, you know, sandals and patchouli smell in the air.
No, more like Camaros and Final Net cans, really.
Well, and that's Florida. That's where I grew up.
Well, my parents are in Florida now to get revenge on me.
Actually, there was more patent leather exported to Long Island than any other place in the world.
Oh, my God. What is that? A book? That would make for a good hat on you. I knew guys who would, like, watch the Joey Buttafuoco trial and break off into discussion groups, you know? Like, it was just Guido City and...
discussion groups.
So was your aim to start out as a comedian, or did you do other entertainment
avenues?
Yeah,
no, I started out as an actor and went to NYU Film School, and then I was just doing lots of, like, weird avant-garde plays around, you know, the village, and I began doing stand-up about 15 years ago because I was already doing it for people and, like, hosting functions and things like that. So I thought, all right, let me go ahead and do it. And, you know, it's always funny when you do your first open mic. So I invited, like, 25 people so I couldn't back out of it. And then, yeah, within a year and a half, I was able to quit my day job and make bad television for a living. So,
but you're smart. You're good looking. You don't seem like you, I mean, and very intelligent in your comedy that you ever would have done the Middle America circuits.
Well, I certainly have.
I don't think you've done a lot of the holes that I've done.
The laugh hole in Possum Valley, Arkansas.
You know, I mean, being liberal and, you know, left wing in a coffee shop in the village
does,
is one thing, but, you know.
Yeah, no, you're right. It
if
does,
you got any balls, you take that to Shreveport, Louisiana.
Well, you know what?
See how they feel about it.
I happen to have said balls. In fact, I haven't toured Middle America as much as I'd like, although, because I had an experience, I did America's Funniest Home Videos for 2 years, along with Daisy Fuentes.
Wow.
Remember that.
Yeah, I would set up jokes for her to deliver the punchlines.
What's the worst thing you can tell us about her?
Worst
I'm
thing?
Joking. She's, no, she's beautiful. I'm joking.
She's a beautiful
totally
woman, right?
Now, I always,
even as we speak, she's in the lab working out cold fusion right now.
I mean, always hated
she's great.
I always hated like those America Funniest Videos types of shows. I've always been intellectual snobbery has
me
kept
too.
Me from enjoying a lot of things.
Me too.
Stock car racing, pro wrestling. I mean, pro wrestling is theater, but you get to spit on the actors. It's fantastic.
No, pro wrestling is gay porn waiting to happen. Is what pro wrestling is. Pro wrestling's a homoerotic cry for help. Okay, that's what pro wrestling is.
Yeah.
That's the Brokeback Red State Mountain. Is what pro wrestling is.
But. I don't know. He sure got a lot of them wrestling posters in his room.
Exactly, and your man panties and your greased up chest. And, yeah.
What was the point about intellectual?
Cerebral. comedy with going into Middle America, and it's true. It's
I'm sorry. The intellectual snobbery kept me from enjoying like America's Funniest Home Videos.
That's
and then
not snobbery.
A friend of
That's
mine
taste.
In Holland.
That's taste.
A friend of mine in Holland. He watched those shows, and he would laugh hysterically. And like my brother, my oldest brother's kind of a goon, and he used to read the funny pages in the newspaper, and just be laughing hysterically at each one of them. And I'd read the paper and like not a chuckle. Like I always thought they were stupid.
Yeah.
But so this guy made me watch America's Home. Nothing is funnier than a little baby toddler falling down and
you
hitting
know what?
His head.
It's amazing how it's hilarious.
Funny over and over. It's like Benny Hill when he would smack the bald guy on the head. It's funny every time.
And when it's animals or old people, it's even funnier than infants. And and it was a humbling feeling to know that I was being seen every week by millions of people on millions of TVs in some of the really finest trailer parks this country has. But I was way too serious, and I had a real. I guess snobbery is the best. At the time, I thought I had a lot of taste, and I was, you know, I thought it was going to be a lot smarter. And the show forced me to lighten up quite a bit and realize how much joy it brought to people, and to check my own snobbery. And that was just me being insecure about what I was doing and not appreciating, you know, the blessing of having a really fun gig like that.
Well,
so,
sure. Well,
you know, I was like 26 years old. So,
but I want to ask you, you know, you hosted this Paul McCartney event. Was that was for after George Harrison died?
No, that was actually the same week as I interviewed George Harrison.
Oh my God, because that's. We're all Beatles freaks here.
Well, then let me tell you something. I got some stories about Paul. I'll tell you off the air. But I was doing this.
Come on.
I was working for VH1, and I'm doing stand up. And they said, you know, they said Paul McCartney's chosen you to interview him for his live town hall because they didn't have a lot of classic rock guys. They hired
big
me to be
fan of America's Funniest Home Videos.
This is before this is before that even happened.
Wow.
But I was like the one classic rock guy. They were at the time they were becoming more of a music first format. And they were hiring a lot of models to talk about Led Zeppelin.
Great.
So I was the comic. They hired, and I was the only guy who knew about rock, so I wound up doing a lot of VJ work. And Paul picked me to fly over, and I'm all set to go. And then a week before, they call me, and I'd never been overseas, and they said, listen, you've got to leave on Thursday. You can't leave on Wednesday. And I'm like, why? I want to go to London. They said, well, we need you in New York to interview George Harrison and Ravi Shankar.
Wow.
And
the Beatles gods were smiling on you.
And I'm a George guy.
I'm a George guy, 100% my favorite Beatle. Absolutely.
I'll hook you up with some great bootlegs.
Now, this is a strange game that I invented that I've asked only the hugest Beatles fans. And I want to present the question to you, and I would like all of us to answer and us talk about it.
It's so hard to find people
you're
who know
in
the Beatles
a plane crash. Mm-hmm. You're in a plane crash in the Andes. With the Beatles in their prime, which Beatle would you eat last? I would eat George last, for me personally. I'd eat Ringo first. I think most people would eat Ringo first. Who would you?
Well, the irony is that all four of them became vegetarians. So I'd have this meal to myself.
This game wouldn't work with them.
Well, no, it's which one I would eat first. I'm only a vegetarian 25 days in the month, so I'm okay on that. Which would I eat last? I'd have to say, well, George was the skinniest. I'd have to go with George. But also George, because he'd make me, we'd have enough of a spiritual denial bonding session, I wouldn't feel bad about eating John and Paul.
Yeah, I think George was the most mellow, happy guy, full of love. And
personally, is this before Yoko or after Yoko? Because I wouldn't eat John after Yoko. Because too much. Let's just say pharmaceutically, John was not a safe culinary bet. After
wow!
Yoko.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, so
very good
if
point.
If it's pre-Yoko, I'm not going to eat John at all. I'll pass on that, and I'll feed on some soccer players on the next plane.
My oldest brother, my brother John, who's an army guy, right wing, Christian Republic, hardcore, big football bully guy, complete opposite of me. Interesting guy. He's been an antagonist in my life, and he gave me the most interesting answer to this question. He would eat Ringo last. And he would eat John Lennon first. And I said, why? And he goes, well, John Lennon was a jerk. You know, he was funny, but, you know, to be a guy's friend would have been a drag. He's just constantly being a jerk, putting people down. And I go, okay, why would you eat Ringo last? And he goes, because he's the funniest. So, I mean, like, how do you want to be remembered? As a comedian, political analyst, actor?
First comic to win the Nobel Peace Prize.
That cheers to that, my friend. Somebody's got to do it.
You got to have a peace prize named after the guy who invented dynamite.
Aiming high in comedy, because, you know, so many comedians go for the lowest common denominator. Now, what did you think of the...
You say that in L.A.? Really?
The English comedy scene. Did you do a lot of work over there?
No, I did a lot of TV over there, not so much stand-up, but I'm a big fan of it. I mean, and people have always told me, you know, you've got to go over and start doing the U.K. and playing over there, and it's been something that
I love to rock in other countries. It feels so good. And especially when you're now, it'll, you know, the world loves us. But yeah, like you were saying about playing in the Midwest, doing jokes about Bush.
Well, you know, but it's true. And in many ways, I wanted to go overseas the last couple of years because I was doing so much political stuff, and they would have appreciated it. And I'll tell you, I've never been so happy to have to dump half my material. It's a lovely thing.
Yeah, it's a new generation.
Great excuse.
Earlier today, for the first time, I was accused of being racially offensive by a white person. So I'm looking forward to 4 years of that now.
It's all coming to a gel.
Well, I love Obama, but he's not a liberal, and a lot of liberals are going to have to accept the fact. I voted for him. I voted for him twice this year. I voted in the primary. I've never done that in my life. But, you know, he's pro-death penalty. He voted for Patriot Act 2. He voted for the telecom immunity bill. Men, that allows Google to turn over all your porn records to the government, and you can't sue them. And he voted for this bailout. So it's like, you can love the guy. But he's more in the Bill Clinton moderate Republican club than he is in the actual Dennis Kucinich, Mahatma Gandhi, Jesus liberal club that people
right.
think
now,
he's in.
Now, you know, the funny thing was, like, my family's all very right-wing. I'm, you know, the black sheep, obviously. But I turned out the way I am because of them. But their big thing against Obama, and I heard it from a lot of people, and they were just regurgitating the hate radio that they listen to.
Of course. It's all talking.
And he's a socialist. He's a Marxist.
Yeah.
And my point was, you know, the banks just got taken over by the government. What's more Marxist than that?
Well, exactly. We're all socialists
now. I mean, shouldn't we at
now.
Least get some health care out of that?
When they say he's a socialist, you say, you mean like Jesus?
Yeah, exactly.
And,
yes.
And watch their heads explode. Because I always say to these folks, and you know, I come from a big Southern family, very conservative, and big Brooklyn family, very conservative. And I always say, Jesus, this guy of whom you speak, was a peaceful, radical, nonviolent revolutionary who hung around with lepers and hookers and crooks. He never spoke English, wasn't an American citizen, anti-capitalist, totally anti-death penalty, anti-public prayer, Matthew 6:5, look it up, anti-public prayer, but never anti-gay, and didn't mention abortion, and was a long-haired, brown-skinned, it's in the book, homeless Middle Eastern Jew.
Wow.
That's Jesus.
I
Amen.
Love you for saying
if
that.
If you're a fundamentalist Christian, that's the conservative point of view. Amen.
I love you for saying that. I am pro-Jesus, and he's one of my heroes in life.
I view Jesus the way I view Elvis. I love the guy. The fan clubs freak me out.
Jesus turned water into wine. Jesus was a partier. I mean, what element in the desert is more important than water? And he said, hey, you know, he turned water into wine. I think that just shows what kind of guy he was.
And
he was,
a lot of people don't understand, too, that he was kind of like a loner, kind of like a bluesy kind of guy. He'd go out in the desert 40 days by himself, mm-hmm. just, you know, fast and pray. And, you know, I mean, when you get that deep inside your own head, you know, I mean, he's an interesting person. So therefore, the opinions that he came back with were pretty pure.
Well, and that's the
beautiful
thing
you said before, John. That you before we got started, you said that you were taking Jesus back from.
I want to. My goal as a comic or as an artist is to take the flag back from the assholes and take Jesus back from the hypocrites, reclaim love from the saps, and rescue sex from the vulgarians. Because it's
Yay.
The best thing we can hope to do. And I grew up in an extremely Catholic family.
Right.
We had open casket reunions, but you know, with Jesus, when you realize your mom was married to him before your dad, it makes you kind of take a second look at him.
Can I be your apostle, Tom? Thomas.
I'll be your apostle.
I would like to be your apostle,
well,
Thomas.
Well, if you're Thomas, you'll be doubting me all the time,
like
so I don't know if I can handle
I'd
a
like
doubting
to put
apostle.
My finger in your little sword
I
hole.
I want a yes apostle. I don't know. I'm writing a book right now. I'm writing a book that's on how to win any argument, how to use the Bible to win any argument with your conservative Christian loved ones on everything from illegal immigration to death penalty to economics, because Jesus was not conservative. He was the original rock the boat, hardcore revolutionary
Amen.
Who believed in love and did not have any problem with our friend the gays.
John Fugelsang, you've been absolutely incredible.
It's been a pleasure to be here. I wish you the best of luck. It's great to see like brilliant, funny, talented people with heart and guts and brains and balls doing comedy radio. Thank
John,
you.
God bless you, brother.
God
keep the laughs
well.
Coming, baby.
Holla.
May the Father shine his face towards you.
Mechaleka hi, mechahine hi.
Wow, a zombie blessing. And our special guest tonight, two stand-up comics that need no introduction, so I just say their names. Jimmy Stewart.
Jimmy Stewart.
Jimmy Stewart. I
Jimmy Schubert is here.
He needs no introduction. Bob Thompson. Listen, I told you I'd never forget you, Bobby. Listen, right? Bobby Schubert, I told you I'd never forget you. You're my favorite. I love him to death. I take a bullet for him.
Great,
please welcome
Tommy.
My good friend.
Paul, whatever the hell your name is.
Lou, it's Jim Schubert. Jimmy Schubert. Thank you.
He's only known you 18 years.
Yeah.
Still
yeah.
Easy on
it's all right. He stubbed his all tongue. Right. Give him a break.
He stubbed his tongue.
And, of course, Billy Gardell is here as well.
Hello, boys. Thanks for having me. Yeah.
Fellas, and I wanted to have you because as an anthropological study of the state of Pennsylvania, because in my opinion...
Just say everybody else said
I always think Jewish people and black people are the funniest because they suffered. I mean, my favorite comedians are Jewish or black, but also people from Pennsylvania, I find, are hysterical. So what kind of suffering have you done?
We've suffered. We have suffered.
Now, tell me, what suffering have you done in Pennsylvania?
Hey, I'm Irish. Read about the Irish slave trade, you know what I mean? And then read about...
I was just in Ireland. I don't remember any of the Irish history happening in Philadelphia.
Well, I came over on the boat with my in my grandfather's sack, all right? I was swimming around through my you know, anyway, the point is... I've suffered. Look, I can't
I think
even
people
notice.
From Pennsylvania. I'll take it.
Thanks. Well, Philly's a tough town. I could believe that. I mean, were you abused?
Well, listen, I can't go out and get suntan. I don't have any pigment. I was in the Bahamas. It was like 90 degrees. The only thing that had any color was my liver. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it was, you know.
But, and you guys were in the Bahamas together, you were telling me.
We were, man. Yeah, yeah. Jimmy kept trying to race me down the water slide. He doesn't understand gravity. I got him by 100 pounds. It was like Fat Man, a little boy up there. Yeah. Destroyed him every time.
And you were in Atlantis. You
absolutely.
Said.
Yeah, I had to cheat. I had to like one on three. One. Just get a jump.
They had a tube that went right through the sharks, and I swear to God, they were eyeing me, Lou. It was like a big shark in there. I almost got that pulled off. Right? The fat one's coming. We got him. This is lunch.
The sharks were putting on their lobster bibs. You know? Yeah. Sharpening the knives. Hey, look, but now, how is the Atlantis?
Beautiful. Beautiful, man. It was one of those gigs that you can't believe they hired you.
Yeah.
What was the gig that you did?
There was a radio show took us with their bring-along package, and we were the entertainment for the night. And I don't know who thought
of that.
Where
they bring a bunch
grateful.
Of listeners, winners?
Yeah, they bring them all over to the – and they put them in a ballroom, and then they put me and this moron up on stage together.
That's great. I did a show like that a couple years ago where 98 Rock from Baltimore took me and 300 winners to Cancun. and I got to perform, and it was great. And it was a resort. It wasn't as fancy as Atlantis, I'm sure, but it was a little resort in Cancun, and it was really fantastic because the resort was filled with Germans and Italians and all these, like, you know, French.
Oh, your pals.
Just European tourists. And then mixed in with all the...
You know
the,
what? Rudd has been that guy since I was 18.
Listen.
You go, what are you working
on? Can I finish the story?
I'm working on the coast of Bora Bora. That's great, Tom. I'm going to Cleveland this week, but
thank
you.
Well, you just were in the Bahamas, so... here's my comparative story.
Go ahead.
Thanks for making the punchline that much longer to get to. I'm with all these winners, and there's all these Europeans staying at the resort, and mixed in with all the European tourists were all these, like, rock and roll tattooed Baltimore people in cut-off shorts. Nice. And it was amazing the amount of Baltimore Oriole tattoos that I had. Because, you know, if you're going to have something on your body permanent, why not the ultimate symbol of mediocrity? The symbol of the Baltimore Orioles.
He's a happy little bird, though.
But it was classic. I loved it. I had a great time of my life. People doing cannonballs into the pool.
Well, it's in that Baltimore audience, that was the only time you can reference Boog Powell. And everybody in the whole room knows who you're talking about.
I just got a ball replacement.
How'd that work out for
nice.
You?
Nice. It's a prosthetic in there.
Nice.
I needed to bag
sounds
that.
Sounds like a clacker when
you'll
walk.
You'll never drown.
Everybody grab Jimmy's balls. We're going to float the happiness.
Thank God for my prosthetic nut. It's the only thing that saved my life.
It wouldn't sink. Just held me up there by the skin of my...
Hey, don't get testy with me.
Oh,
one? Singular?
Well, amen. You
know, I think the sarcasm from Pennsylvania comes from the years of coal mines and steel mills, and then when that went away, the sarcasm developed even heavier, and you had to make a joke so you didn't walk down the hall with a pump shotgun. I think that's working.
Thank you, Billy. You gave me my answer.
Thanks, I knew we'd get to it. I just needed a minute. It's like the early days. It just takes me a minute.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, I grew up with six brothers, so it was constant ball busting. I mean, it was like, you know, in Philly, that is a form of affection. If you're busting someone's chops, it means you like them.
It's like group sex.
But if you didn't, just like like that.
Right. Now,
except nobody has an orgasm, and we got our clothes on, and some guy just gets his feelings hurt. It's exactly like that.
Plus,
in every other way.
They believe in the reverse psychology, too. Their favorite thing to tell you when you come out of there is, you can't do that. And then if you do it, they go, see, I told him he couldn't do it, and then he becomes something. And then if you don't become that, you go, I told you you couldn't do nothing. I've been shot up. So,
now, which city do you think is tougher, Pittsburgh or Philadelphia?
Well, you know, they're both tough towns. They both have that, you know, it's the Pennsylvania.
Who can work the hardest? Who can work the longest?
They're the great blue-collar working-class towns, you know. Yeah. They love their sports teams. They got great food. Yeah. You know, Pirani Brothers sandwich.
Pirani Brothers. Yeah, 3,500 calories a sandwich.
Yeah.
Nice.
You want to bring them back to L.A. and force feed one to a model, watch her head explode.
Yeah.
Just the grease. Boom! What happened?
Extra Velveeta.
Absolutely.
I remember I was in Philadelphia a couple years ago, and I was doing yoga a lot, and I'm walking to this yoga class with a yoga
mat. You were doing Philly and yoga?
I'm walking to Philadelphia with a yoga mat, and I'm like, wait a minute. This is how people get hurt.
But my uncle does Irish yoga. He goes to the bar, and then we find him on the floor stretched out. It's a little Irish yoga, man.
Whatever.
Philadelphia. What a yoga mat. That's a brave man. That's a brave man.
In Philadelphia, when I was there, they have the toughest local news I've ever seen. Like, a human head was found rolling down Walnut Street. And the guy, like, said it like it happens all the time. It was like he was so not surprised.
Well, you know what's funny? My dad was a Philly cop. You know, he was a detective.
Oh, so he must know.
And he told me, and he's, you know, we tell you these stories. You know, I love it. Like, you know, bedtime stories from a Philly cop. Bus driver comes in. He's pulling into the station. But before he pulls in the station, he stops at the corner ball. He's getting off his shift. He goes in for a bat and a ball. I said, what's a bat about? It's a shot and a beer, son. He goes in for the shot. And he comes out and he sees his bag. And it's like a shopping bag. And it's a couple days before Christmas. And he picks it up. He runs on the bus. He shuts the door. He opens the package. There's a box in there. He opens it up and a human head falls out and rolls down the bus steps and out onto the sidewalk. The guy screams. The cops show up and he's in the corner, just keep taking another shot and a beer just to calm his nerves. And they found a human head. Huh. I didn't know who belonged to.
See, it's a common story in Philadelphia.
So what they did was they took the guy's head and they put it in the back of a paddy wagon and were having people. Do you recognize the head? I don't recognize it. People are having bad dreams. They finally took the head down to the methadone clinic and a couple guys go, that sure do look like Leroy, but last time I saw him, he was a hell of a lot taller.
Leroy's lost his head before, never like this.
Yeah, but they found a body down in the city dump, and they matched up the head to the body. Problem solved. Anyway, kids, sleep tight. I love you. I'll see you in the morning.
I got lights out.
Now, wow. did your father ever, was he retired policeman?
No, he's retired now, but he worked a long time. He told me this hilarious story. Because Halloween just passed, which I remember.
Yeah, you could base a movie on your dad.
This is hilarious. The captain of the squad goes about 6'5", 270.
I'll be playing him next year.
Yeah, yeah. And he's a big guy. He used to be a motorcycle cop. He's a captain of the squad, and he's getting ready to leave early so he can go to a costume party with his wife. So at the end of the day, he's dressed in his giant bunny rabbit outfit, and he took his nightstick, and he wrapped it with plaster of Paris, painted it orange, and put a little green thing on the top so it looked like a carrot. But just before the guy's getting ready to go out, they catch this bank robbery suspect. He was driving the car, and they bring him in to question him. And this means the guy's going to miss the party. He goes, no, no, no. And they're in there interrogating him, go, you know, tell us the story. Go F yourself. Go F your, I ain't saying nothing. And he goes, I can't be here all night. So he goes, you tell that son of a bitch, if he don't start talking, he's going to meet the rabbit. And he goes, listen, you better fess up. Otherwise, you go, hey, man, F you and F the rabbit, man, I don't care. He goes, all right, I warned you. Guy gets up, walks out, shuts the light off, and closes the door. 5 minutes later, you just hear the door open slowly. You see this giant rabbit silhouetted, and he comes hopping in the room with his billy club and just starts beating on the guy. And just starts whack, 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 and the guy, and he hops out of the room. And the guy gets back in, now you going to talk or you want to meet the rabbit? No, I'll tell you what happened. Let's keep the rabbit out there. The next day in court, he's up there going, judge, this is not fair. I got beat by a giant rabbit last night. He beat me with a carrot. The judge sent him down to psychiatric evaluation. You know what I mean? You know, what happened was it was such an effective interrogation technique that they used it a couple other times until the judge finally called down there and said, listen, if I hear another guy come through my courtroom saying he got beat by a giant rabbit, there's going to be problems. So straighten it out over there. I don't know what you got to do or what's going on, but you better not hear one more rabbit story, not a guy eating carrots. You better clean it up over there.
That's amazing.
That's hysterical. What was your favorite toy as a child?
My favorite toy would have to be, I would say, you remember that wind-up Evel Knievel?
That was mine.
Remember that?
We've had this conversation. You hit the plunger, and then Evel Knievel doll on his little motorcycle.
He would just hit the button and go.
And it had a ramp, and he would jump things.
Yeah.
And that was all good until you took it outside one time into the street.
Well, that's what I did. It was my favorite toy as a child.
And it broke his arm in a bad landing.
Well, this is what happened. It was my favorite toy as a child, and I thought his jumps needed to progress on the danger level.
Sure.
So I filled the
sell
driveway.
Tickets, Tom.
Exactly.
Sell tickets.
I knew showbiz at the time, and I filled the driveway with gasoline.
Dang.
And I set it on fire, and I wound up the Evel Knievel, and I hit it, and it goes through it, and it fell halfway on its side, and it melted onto the motorcycle. And for years, I've always told that doll was my favorite toy. But now I realize, after telling the story so many times, fire was my favorite toy as a child. I burned everything. Those little plastic army men, I would put a book of matches in between them, and a squirt gun full of gasoline, and
That was when you played outside, too. That's good stuff.
Hold on. Tommy's making you think he did this when he was 8 years old.
No, right.
That was last week.
We were roommates in Orlando in the 90s, and he was doing that stuff.
No, when I was a kid, I used to set everything on fire. I set a field on fire once, I went in my room.
A
I went
field?
At,
it was a field
It was
on
a field
fire?
Next to our house. I was playing fireman, right? And I would, like, put out the fire with the garden hose, but it got out of control, and I couldn't put it out. And I don't know, it was like 5 or 6 or 7, and, like, the fire trucks are coming, and I went to my room and pretended like I was like doing something else. It's like all of a sudden I'm catching up on my golden book reading.
Yeah. You're doing your studies. You remember when that was the answer when you were a kid? No matter what you did bad outside, if I just go in the house and lay down, this is going to all blow over. I don't know what happened out there. I'm doing an encyclopedia reading right now. Please don't bother me.
Tommy's in the
room. I'm with you, Tom.
What, me? I was just sticking the pin.
Yeah, smoke's coming off his jacket. His fingers are all black. I haven't done nothing. I haven't done nothing. What happened? That's just why my own business.
Why you got to blame me, man?
You know, I love the water pistol full of gasoline, you know.
That's
what?
Great.
That's
great.
Awesome. Idea. Yeah, you can hit the pumpkins on Halloween with that, too.
That's really great
idea. It was so great.
Nice, bro.
So we got all the Pennsylvania people here, and there's one of the amazing things about Pennsylvania. That's where Zippo lighters are
That's
made.
Right.
I love Zippo lighters.
In fabulous Bradford, Pennsylvania.
You remember years ago when I went to Vietnam, I brought back all these the Zippos that the soldiers had, and nobody wanted one.
I took one off you.
Did you?
Yeah, still got it.
I think you were a little weirded out by it, Lou.
It was one of the few times you were actually nice to me. I got a lighter. He was a punk. You remember
Zippo lighters were, in
just
fact...
Just gorgeous with a big shiny belt, all the girls chasing him around.
It's
hard to talk to him in those days.
Zippo lighters...
Hard to talk to him in those days.
Zippo lighters...
Tommy, he's so clever. Look at his notebook. It has stickers on it. He's a genius. They'd follow him around in a line. Me and Rogers would be out front going, Rogers would be dressed just like him. I'm too fat to buy the clothes. We're just standing there. It sucks. It's never going to work out.
Speaking of Zippo lighters, those Zippo lighters were, in fact, America's most powerful weapon in Vietnam.
They were?
Oh,
is that right?
You live in a grass house.
Oof. So the moral of the story is, if you live in a glass house, don't use a Zippo lighter.
Grass. You can't light
grass
the gas.
Hole.
In fact, people that are trying to quit smoking, it's one. If you use a Zippo lighter, one of the things they tell you to do is to get your Zippo lighter out of your periphery if you're trying to quit smoking, because the sound and the smell.
It's so great.
How about
I love
that clink?
I love this cigarette lit by a Zippo, and the sound and the pop is so fantastic. And I just like having fire in my pocket, plus, basically, because it's like, you know, the cavemen couldn't figure out fire, and I have it in my pocket.
Yeah, yeah.
But the other cool thing is that no one's walking off with your Zippo. Give me the Zippo.
That's right.
That ain't a Bic. It ain't a Bic, right?
It is one of the most Pavlovian responses out there.
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
Without a doubt.
Clink. Pavlovian. Does that name ring a bell? Anybody? Anybody?
Reaching. Yes. You're reaching. After further review.
The play stands in the field. Challenged.
Somewhere in each of our careers, you had an aha moment where you went, this is what I'm going to do forever. And you had completely made up your mind. I know a lot of people, including myself, kind of kibitzed with it a little bit. We do a little stand-up, work a day job, do a little stand-up, work a day job. But there was a time in everybody's career, maybe not Tom, where you said, this is it. I'm in. I don't care what it takes. If I got to eat ramen noodles until something happens. Can you remember, was there a decisive day anybody got there?
Yeah, I remember the first time I did, like, I was still working the door and doing, like, open mics in L.A. when I first got out here.
Uh-huh.
And the first night I was able to do five, 15-minute sets. It's like we start at the Natural Fudge about 7:30, and I would drive right from a day job there. I'd sit there and meet up with Noodles Levinstein. He watched my act, and I watch his. We take notes. We drive over to Monty Steakhouse in Westwood, take it up to the 15th floor, do a set, take more notes, talk about it on the way to the Alley Cat Bistro over in Culver City. From there, we'd go over to Monty's. We go over to this. There's a room in the Hyatt. Right next to the Comedy Store that did comedy on Monday nights. And then you could shoot over to Monday night and get a late night spot at the Comedy Store. I remember the first time I did that, I felt like I had definitely become more than just a guy who was kind of, I said, I got this. I can do this. Because the sets got progressively better. And it's, I breathed it. I ate it. I slept it. I was thinking about it all the time. It was just on my mind. I couldn't wait to get back out there and start doing it again. Right. And the first time that happened, that was, I remember that aha moment. I go, ah, yeah.
This is it.
Yeah. And the other one was when I was in a motorcycle accident and I had an option to go home and kind of heal myself, but I didn't want to because I thought that this was too important. I could tough through it and get through it. And I was kind of on pins and needles. I had the thing hanging out of my leg and stuff. And I did that for about 3 years and I finally got back on my feet and was able to, you know, take it from there. So I thought that if that was a test, that this is something I should be doing with my life, that I didn't be, that I can quit on it and give it up when the chips were down. And I thought that this, I could make this from here if I could get through this, you know.
And it's worked out great. Billy?
I don't know, man. I have a lot of aha moments hoping that I can go back home.
Uh-huh.
You know, I think for me it was probably the first time I got on TV as an actor. Because I like being a comic, but like Tommy's a comic.
Right.
Schubert's a comic.
Right.
I'm a guy that can throw some bar lines around, right. But I'm a better actor than I am a comic. I always have been. And the first time I was ever on a TV set and got a laugh from a live audience, for some reason, that laugh was more important to me than my first stand-up laugh. This first stand-up laugh was like, wow, I don't have to lift boxes every day. And that was big. But the first time I actually got in front of a camera and it was going to be on TV and I could call my parents and say, hey, I'm going to be on TV, to me, that was my favorite thing that I ever did. But now I'm past the point of wanting any kind of fame or recognition. I just literally want enough money to go back east and buy a house with a pool, DirecTV. I don't have a lot of big needs anymore, Lou. They've been skimmed down.
Nice.
I want to watch my kid play baseball. That's really where I'm at. And I just need to figure out a way to make enough money so I can do that. Yeah, you know,
it's the house that jokes
built. That's it. That's where I'm at, man. Yeah.
And Tom, I mean, I'll give you a little intro. You started hitchhiking the gigs when you were 17 years old.
But my aha moment came when I was 12. My father did...
12?
My uncle did stand-up comedy. Uncle Bob did open mic nights in Washington, D.C. for a year. And my dad took me to see him when I was 12. And the stage was right next to the door. And we walked in, and I was wearing a Washington Redskins coat. And the comedian on stage... grabbed me and interviewed me like I was the coach of the Redskins. And I was 12, and I just gave goofy, you know, bashful one word answers, yes and no. But I'll never forget standing on stage and seeing the people laughing in their faces. And then I sat at the bar and sipped Cokes for the rest of the night, and that was the aha moment that changed my life.
Really?
And then I was kept notebooks. from 12 onwards, and I started doing open mic nights at 17.
Well,
and,
you used to,
and then I hitchhiked to gigs.
You used to do the announcements at the school.
I did. I did the. I'm from a small town, and it was a small school, and everybody knew I wanted to be a comedian, so I got to do the morning and afternoon announcements, and I got to host the pep rallies.
What was a great joke you used to do about that?
There was a kid that I went to school with my senior year, and he said that he had heard voices that told him to kill his mother, and he beat his mother to death with a baseball bat. And that happened like a year or two after we got out of school. And the guy is still in prison. I mean, how many years? That's been over 20 years. Mm-hmm. And I knew the kid was weird in high school. I had biology class with him. And one time he just started beating this frog to death with a pencil. And I'm like, hey, dude. He's like, I hear voices. I'm like, man, they canceled track practice. Deal with it.
That's hilarious. Do you remember that the Disciples show we did in Orlando at the Tupperware Center? Before the show got started, the roof off and let the air out.
For those of you listening, the Disciples of Comedy show was a traveling stand-up show.
And the one sketch with Carl LeBeau was in it, but it was the great Quadriplegio. Ladies and gentlemen, and I wheeled him out on stage, and he was the only quadriplegic magician working today. He was in a wheelchair, and I would come out, and Ron would be like, so you ready? He goes, I'm ready. And then you go, you're going to do the disappearing candle trick. And then I would do the trick, and I'd, you know, do this whole thing. I used to be a magician, so I would do this thing with the candle and light it. And then, and he would go, da-da! After it was done. I went to like three tricks, and the bird came out, and then he was wearing a blanket off his lap, and we pulled it out, and I gave it to Bennington. It's the great quadriplegio with a wheelchair off the O, and it was the great disappearing wheelchair illusion. One, two, three. You pull it away, and he's laying on the ground without the wheelchair. Da-da! And we had to like bow him out. It was actually pretty funny.
You were a magician once?
I was a magician.
He's a great magician.
I would love to see you as a magician. Hey, pay attention, you humps.
Listen, yeah.
that's like your setups.
Yeah, that's me at a kiddie's party. That's me at a kiddie party, picking up money.
Because I love you, and I'm magicians are weird for me. I don't like magicians or magic tricks. And even if it's a card trick, whenever I see a magician do a trick, I always go, when the trick is done, I always go, burn him, he's a witch.
That's why we don't have as many magicians working today.
That's why you didn't get on the Chris Angel special.
Yeah, well, you know, it's something you started. It actually was a great, to get good at that, or to apply that discipline and practicing all those tricks for 8 hours every day, and to kind of make your transition just from when I started doing stand-up when I was like 17. Going down to the Comedy Factory.
I never knew that about you.
Yeah, yeah.
And the Tupperware Theater, I grew up in Orlando.
Right.
When I was 15, I saw Rodney Dangerfield. And I worshipped Rodney Dangerfield. And I had every album memorized. And I went there with my buddy from high school. I didn't have a driver's license. He was a year older. John Forrester. And we went. And he was also a big fan. And Rodney was smashed. He's completely hammered, and he's screwing up the jokes, and we knew every joke, and he's, you know, he's screwing them up, and he was just completely plastered drunk, and it was, you know, I still loved it, but the jokes were, you know, mangled and inaudible, and the show ended, and Orlando was like a kind of a medium, small-sized town then. The show ended, there was no security. I mean, my buddy jump on stage, we go backstage, and Rodney Dangerfield is sitting in the dressing room in his underwear. And I found out years later that was an old vaudeville trick, that these guys would take their, or Catskills rather, they would take their pants off so you don't get them wrinkled.
Yeah.
So he comes off stage, obviously, takes his pants off. Here's my hero, drunk, sitting in his underwear.
Like De Niro.
He had Miller Lite backstage. And we're like, Rodney, sign this. And the paper wasn't even worth saving. It was just a wavy line. He was so hammered, he couldn't write his name. And then finally, like his tour manager or somebody comes and goes, hey, kids, you got to get out of here. And we're like, Rodney, man, we want to talk to Rodney. And he's like, okay, look, go out this door. We're coming out in a little bit and, you know, Rodney will sign whatever and talk to you. So we're outside for a few minutes and Rodney Dangerfield comes out and he's just so plastered and there's a Lincoln Town Car waiting for him. And there's three cement steps from the door to the car waiting for him. And Rodney's so hammered, he goes, "Hey, kids, help me." And he puts one arm around me and one arm around John Forrester. And I'm never forget, you know, lifting this old man's torso down and putting him into the car because he's so hammered he couldn't do those three steps. And he gets in the car and the door closes and he drove away. And it was at that point that I realized what I wanted to do with my life.
I'm crying like Miss America right now.
That's a great story. That's a feel-good story of the year. And before he pulled away, he rolled down the window and puked on me and my buddy's new shoes. Yeah, that's what I knew.
That's my equivalent of the Mean Joe Green Coke commercial. Hey, kid, catch, you know, throwing
right,
the jersey.
Help me in. Will you help me in? You're all right.
I'm not trying to make any new friends, all right, kid?
What was your favorite Rodney Dangerfield joke? Surely you can remember it. One of my favorite Rodney Dangerfield jokes, he goes, "I got mugged in the subway. A guy pulled a razor on me. It's my own fault. I was standing too close to an outlet."
I know you're ugly. When you go to a proctologist and he sticks his finger in your mouth.
I was like the one he said, "Me and my wife, we're going to quit smoking. We're only going to smoke after sex. She's up to 2 packs a day."
My favorite was, "My wife hears the garbage truck pull away, and she runs on. She goes, 'Am I too late?' He goes, 'No, jump on.'"
Dana, do you have a favorite on Dangerfield joke?
I just enjoy going to Dangerfields in New York so I can get that special creepy feeling. It seems to never leave that place.
And a $92 bar tab.
Yeah.
I had a Sprite. How is this possible?
Everybody used to pay. The money was still sopping wet. You know? Dangerfields. Yeah. Throw your name down.
Well, we were up there, right? Yeah, that was the pink paint story. We were at Dangerfields together. Yeah. Tell them the story about the pink paint.
Oh, it was great. I used to run into Tom like every, I don't know, 2 years or so.
And New York was so exciting. And
it was really cool. And
you know, you grew up, you're from Pittsburgh, but you grew up in Florida.
Right.
In Orlando. And so, like, us as kids coming from Florida, being in New York was like being on the moon, man.
But he already had it down. Rhodes already had New York down when I got up there. So he took me to all the cool places. Mm-hmm. And as usual, with every Rhodes Gardell story, I ended up not being able to hold enough liquor, and something stupid happens to me.
But fortunately, I had practice carrying drunk comedians.
That's what I'm saying. We were there together. Exactly. So it was years before this. It was a proliferation.
Everybody has a calling.
So, but yeah, we were loaded, and I had this blue Hawaiian shirt on. And man, we were out so late. There was actually nobody in the subway tunnel that night. And I've never before or since seen that. It was just me and Rhodes down there, and he's singing some Doors song, and I'm trying to focus on where he's at so I can get in the train with him. And I'm leaning on this pole, the banister of the steps. And I peel myself off of it, and I go, "Is there something on my back?" And it's just this 2-inch thick pink subway paint, and it's just stuck on me, man. And he made me stay out for like another 3 hours with this giant bulb of paint on my back.
One of the toughest cities in the world, and he's got pink paint. Yeah. Who decided to paint pink in the subway?
I'm running around protecting the gay folks in New York. It was nice. I was like a superhero.
It was like a gay Diver Down album cover.
It was always fun with him. You were always a great tour guide in those cities, especially when I'd never been there. You're always a great tour guide up there. Rhodes always knew some cool thing that nobody else knew about the city. I always enjoyed that.
Yeah, he's like, you know, you've traveled the world, man. I mean, I don't know anybody who's traveled the world.
But he travels differently than me. Rhodes will go out and see all that stuff, and I'm in a hotel, and I'll read about it. Oh, they have that here? That's fantastic.
Yeah, but you guys Rhodes own things.
Make sure he'll have a...
You guys own things. I've blown all my money on exotic trips and women and booze.
Right, yeah, man.
I look no worse for the wear.
You wasted the rest.
Scorekeeper, mark me for an assist.
Tommy has the most elaborate refrigerator magnet collection.
Yes.
And a pretty extensive 5-deep Elvis Creamer collection.
It's time for one of our favorite segments of the show. It's the Street Joke Nationals. On Tower side tonight, it's Jimmy Schubert. And on the Spectator side, it's Billy Gardell. What we're going to do is we're going to have a Street Joke Nationals. Okay.
Wow.
And what was it? This is
Schubert's the king of these. This is great.
So
this is your night.
So what we're gonna do?
I'm in my wheelhouse, bro.
Not my night, Charlie. Not my night.
Simplified.
You should have looked out for me,
Charlie. Remember that night you come by? You said
Lad Lou explain a contest.
Okay.
So, enough. Enough.
So as we have the guests on, we're gonna have them tell their favorite street joke.
All right.
Okay. And then we're gonna make it, give it like funny car noises, like brr, 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 like street car.
You're dragging. You're
okay,
dragging.
Chris, yeah, so let's do it. We get it, bro.
Okay. So on the tower side, it's Jimmy Schubert and the Street Joke Nationals.
All right. This woman wakes up. It's the morning of her 25th wedding anniversary. She's an Irish woman. She reaches over for her husband, Seamus, but he's not in bed. She throws on a bathrobe, and she walks down the steps. And as she's walking down the steps, she can smell all her favorite breakfast foods coming up the stairs. Oh, God. And she walks down to the kitchen. There's her husband, Seamus, in an apron. He goes, sweetie, it's the morning of our 25th wedding anniversary. I made you all your favorite breakfast foods. But not only that, here's $200. I want you to go shopping for a new dress and a new pair of shoes. And don't come back till 6 o'clock this evening because Seamus is making dinner as well. She goes, oh, Seamus. So she runs out. She gets the new dress and the new shoes. And she comes back and she opens the door. And the table's set and there's candles going. And there's a bucket of wine on the thing. And Seamus comes out. He looks a little flustered. He goes, sweetie, you're not going to believe it. I forgot the snails for the escargot. I'm going to run down to the fish market and get a big bag of snails. So he runs to the fish market, gets a big bag of snails. He's walking back up the lane, and there's his buddy O'Malley at the pub going, Seamus, come in for a pint. He goes, I can't. So it's 25th anniversary. I'm going to get the snails home for the escargot. He goes, come in for one pint. So Seamus goes in. Now you cut to 3 o'clock in the morning, and Seamus is hammered. And he's singing Rodney O'Carley songs and tripping down the way. He gets finally up to his house, trips at the front step. The bag of snails smacks up against the door. The bag rips open. The snails fall down out into the middle of the street, and he's all hammering. The next thing you know, the door rips open. His wife's staring at Carol, and she's, you son of a bitch! And he looks at her, and he looks down at the snails. He goes, come on, fellas, we're almost home, boys. Come on, fellas, we're almost home. Everybody into the kitchen.
Very good.
Very nice.
Nice.
All right, here's mine.
Okay.
Guy's been married for 70 years. His wife finally passes away. They're at the church, the services, right? Paul bearers are carrying the casket out. As they come around the corner, they bump the wall. They hear inside the casket, oh. They go, oh, my God, I heard a noise. They open it up. She's alive. It's a miracle. She lives another 20 years. She dies before him again. Same church, same service. They're walking out in the pallbearers. The husband says, hey, watch that corner. Not as good as Jimmy's. Did I lose that? I lost that in the streets.
Your parachute didn't open as good as Jimmy's.
That's all right. What are you going to do? It's good.
Jesus walks into a diner. Of course, this creates a big commotion. Everybody's like, really, Jesus? Is that Jesus? The guy's pulling on the waitress's sleeve. Is that Jesus? She goes, yes, it's Jesus. So he says, oh, I want to buy him a cup of coffee or something. So he sends it down. Jesus says, thank you. The guy next to him, waitress, is that really Jesus? She goes, yes, it is. Well, I want to buy his whole breakfast, okay? So she sends it down. Jesus waves, says thanks. Guy next to him, waitress, she goes, yes, it's Jesus. Well, I want to get him like a cinnamon bun or something. So she sends it down. Jesus waves. Jesus finishes his breakfast, gets up, leaves a big tip because he's Jesus. And as he's walking out, he stops at the first guy and he says, my brother, he says, you bought me a cup of coffee. What a wonderful thing to do. And he rested his hand on his shoulder. And right where he laid his hand, he went, that's amazing. I've had bursitis in that shoulder for years. There's no more pain. Thank you, Jesus. And he stops the next guy, and he rests his hand on the back of his neck. He says, and you bought my whole breakfast. What a wonderful thing. And right where he laid his hand, he went, that's amazing. I've had a stiff neck from a car wreck for years. There's no more pain. Thank you, Jesus. And he goes to reach for the third guy, and he spins around in his stool. He goes, hey, I'm on workman's comp.
Very nice.
That's America, baby. Well, hey, man, you guys have been absolutely great.
Tom, Lou, Dana, thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us in, man.
Thank you, fellas. Pennsylvania love all over the place.
Pennsylvania love, bro. Go Eagles. Go my Eagles. Philadelphia Eagles. I mean, they don't even say Eagles.
Eagles ain't that good. You got to go Steelers.
They go.
It's a high percentage shot, bro. Okay.
It's hilarious.
you're two of my favorite people on the planet, and two of them, but my favorite comedians. Thanks, also. Tom. You guys cracked me up, so thank you for coming.
My pleasure. Well, thank you for having us.
Wow, that was the mother load of talented, funny, wonderful people tonight.
It was incredible. There was a lot of love. There was a lot of laughter. Man, that makes
this is my new favorite show.
I'd have to agree with you.
We are the Unoffendables. Remember, everybody, love is the elevation of understanding. Namaste. Somebody that told me to love my mama. Said the mama told me you gotta take care of mama.